John 1:1-5, The Gospel in Brief, the seventh talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 11, 1997, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Okay, I think what I want to do, I've been debating here how to proceed. I think what I want to do is ask you to do something for me, and that is suspend your hostile reactions and let me speak in terms of telling you what I think this passage means. And I say, I'm anticipating, not hostile, you wouldn't be hostile to me, but being upset by what I'm saying, because what I'm going to say is not exactly the traditional way that people take this passage. But after I want to just lay out what I think the prologue is saying. These first five verses are basically the prologue to John's gospel. Verse 6, he begins to tell the story of the gospel, and the first five verses are the kind of prologue to that. As a piece of literature, I just find it spine tingling in its brevity and its conciseness and its profundity. And I want to lay that out for you as best I can. And then what I want to do is go back and attack the question, why do I take it this way rather than the other ways that it could be taken? And I will present my case there, and then we can open it up for questions. But for the time being, if you have a question, you can jot it down and raise it with me later. But for the time being, let me just suspend your negative reactions, your upsetness, and just listen to what I have to say. Follow me. I'm going to read my own slightly different translation, where I'm not going to translate the Logos, is mostly what I'm not doing, but that's what I'm going to work from. In the beginning was the Logos. Now the Logos was with God. In fact, this Logos was God. This one was in the beginning with God, or this Logos was in the beginning with God. All things came into existence through it. Not one thing which has come into existence has come into existence outside of it. In it was life, and this life was the light of men. Now this light shines in the darkness. The darkness has not extinguished it. He starts off by just simply setting the stage, saying that in the beginning, and I think he means before anything existed at all, the same in the beginning that you find in Genesis when he says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. In that beginning was this thing that he calls the Logos. Well, what does he mean by the Logos? Most of your English translations translate it the word. But if you were to go to a classical Greek textbook, first year primer in classical Greek, not New Testament Greek, but classical Greek, and you were just to get a list of vocabulary words, and they gave you the word logos, more likely than word is going to be something like mind. Mind is probably the one that you'd get in a first year primer. Maybe concept. I'm not sure what else they would use. Pardon?
Might the teacher said reason.
Reason, yeah, reason. Right. Yeah, reason would be a likely. It's a common, ordinary Greek word. It's used with a variety of different meanings. But word is not what typically comes to mind as the most likely translation of logos to a classical Greek teacher. For some reason, in the tradition of translating the Bible, and I could only speculate as to where this comes from, but they've decided that logos means word in the Bible, and so typically in a New Testament Greek primer, they would have logos, word. But logos is a term that you run into all throughout the Greek philosophers. You run into it in Plato, you run into it in Aristotle, you run into it in the Stoics, you run into it in the Epicureans. Every one of the classical Greek philosophers through the post-classical, the Hellenistic philosophers, all of the Greek culture had the concept of the Logos. And every one of them knew what it meant. It meant roughly, very roughly, but roughly what we would mean by Mother Nature. And what I mean by that is, each of them might have had their own, just like we do. I, as a Christian believer, could make a statement saying Mother Nature did this or Mother Nature did that. But it doesn't mean that I have lost sight of the fact that God is providentially in control of all of his creation, including the natural laws and the physical universe, and that it's really God who's doing it. I'm not denying that for a second. By talking about Mother Nature, I'm just talking about that aspect of God's providential control that involves the physical natural world. That's what I would mean by that. And the reason I would use that term is because I don't have in mind a comprehensive view of God's providence. I only have that more limited scope of God's providence in view, that thing that can be captured by the notion of Mother Nature. Well, within the Greek culture, I would argue, there's this sort of this concept of the Logos. Plato's concept of the Logos is different from the Stoics' concept of the Logos, is different from the Epicureans' concept of the Logos, is different from other Greek conceptions of the Logos. But what they can all agree on, is that this world that we live in has been designed. It has an order and a rationality to it. It's not just this random chaotic mess. It works like something that has been rationally organized somehow by someone somewhere. And how do they capture that idea? Well, that mind has been at work, rationality, reason has been at work to give order to this world. And the way they describe that is that's the activity of halagos, the logos, the mind, the reason, the rationality. And what they have in mind is reason with a capital R, that original rationality that gave design and order to the cosmos that we live in. And they may have different conceptions of who or what that mind is. For the Stoics, for example, they thought it was some kind of material substance. Well, obviously, John doesn't think it's some kind of material substance. He goes on to tell us that it's God who it is. But he doesn't have that conception of the Logos. But what all of them shared in common, whether they thought the Logos was spirit or matter or a force or a God or whatever they thought it was, they all agreed that it was that rational, purposing mind that explains why we live in such an orderly, purposive universe. That, I think, is the way John is using this term. He's using it in much the way that I, as a Christian, might use the term Mother Nature. There's a concept out there in our culture that says nature does what nature does. Nature is capable of functioning on its own and producing floods and famines and hurricanes and the rainfall to bring abundant crops and all that kind of stuff. That's all part of the activity of nature in our world. We have that concept, and how do we articulate that? Well, one way is through this Mother Nature image. John is using the Logos image out of Greek culture. So, what he's saying is, in the beginning, was this mind, reason, rationality, this original rationality that gave purpose and order and structure to the whole cosmos. Then he goes on to say, now this Logos was with God. It's not something that came after God, not subordinate to God, not derived from God. It was right, it is as original as God himself. The ordering mind behind the cosmos is as original as God himself. And then he immediately says, indeed, this Logos was God. The reason it was as original as God himself is because it was identical to God himself. Now, identical to God himself, this is John the Jew speaking. In effect, what he's saying is, this logos, this mind that we all know has given structure to this cosmos, I'm here to tell you that's one and the same with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's what he would mean by God here in this context. The God who revealed himself and made promises and covenants with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that very same God who entered into history and made those covenants, is one and the same with that rationality, that mind that has given order and structure through the entire universe that all of us know about. Then, two, I think he's just stating the same thing, setting the stage to make his next point. This Logos was in the beginning with God, and all things came into being through, and I'm going to say it, because in English it's more natural to use the neuter pronoun it, because we're talking about reason, rationality, a mind, not a person as such, but a reason functioning to create the rational order. And all things came into being through it, and apart from it, nothing came into being that has come into being. And he's making a very profound and penetrating claim. Not a single thing that exists, and I would argue, I may be stretching it here, but I think John has this in mind, not anything that exists, nor any happening that occurs, is outside, can come into existence or can occur apart from this, the ordering, structuring mind that lies behind the whole cosmos. The whole cosmos has its design and purpose in through the activity of this mind. So there's nothing that exists and nothing that occurs that is outside the scope of its design and purpose and rational order that it is creating in and reflecting in and embodying in this world, in this created order. In other words, there is no noise in God's universe. There is no static. There is no randomness. Nothing is outside the determinative control of this Logos, who is God, John says. Okay, why is that important? Well, the reason that's important is because then all of cosmic existence and human existence along with it, all of cosmic existence and your and my existence as human beings has some kind of purpose. It has some kind of design. Within the scope of that design and purpose for the cosmos is this thing called life. In it was life, he says in verse 4. In it was life, included in it was life. And this life was the light of men. This is perhaps the most, if I'm understanding this correctly, is perhaps the most important simple statement in the entire New Testament. God has ordered and structured the entire universe, the entire cosmos, included in within the things that he created in the cosmos is this thing called life. We'll have to talk about what that is. But this life, he says, was the light of men. Now, what does he mean by that? Light is an incredibly frequently used symbol in the ancient world, used for a lot of different things, goodness, truth, wisdom, something of value, and it can be used in a lot of different ways. And John doesn't give us a lot of clues here. But my best understanding, my best guess at what he means by it, is that in this case he's using it as a symbol for something that is good. And so to call it the light of men is to be saying that life is man's ultimate good. Good in the sense of ultimate blessing, the thing that is the ultimate reward, the thing that is the ultimate for mankind to achieve in order to be truly blessed and truly rewarded and truly fulfilled and to truly attain to something worthwhile and really, really profoundly valuable. What's the most valuable, the most significant thing a human being could ever attain to? In other words, life. Because life, by God's design, you see what he's saying? By God's design, in terms of the order and structure of the cosmos as God created it, and in the order of human existence as God created it, we were created to enter into life. That's what we were created for. If we fall short of life, we fall short of that for which we were created. That and only that can fulfill us. Okay, so what is life then? Ah, that's the question. John's gospel in particular, but the New Testament in general, John's gospel in particular, is filled with comments about life that often gets called eternal life. Here he just calls it life, but it's clear from the rest of the book of John that what he has in mind is life, what gets translated eternal life, but that's not a particularly happy translation. I would like to just transliterate it. There's a bunch of different Greek phrases that all mean roughly the same thing, and they're all related to this one word, ion, in Greek. So I would call it ionic life. An ion is an age. And the view that seems to be lie behind the language that the New Testament writers use is that you could look at all of cosmic history from the point when there was nothing to way into eternity, and there become crucial turning points in that cosmic history that can be grouped into what are called ages. And I'm not sure what the dividing lines are, they don't bother to tell us, but we are in a certain age right now, a present age right now, but according to the New Testament, the day is going to come where this is all going to burn up, this is all going to go in flames and be utterly destroyed. And when that happens, God is then going to create a new heavens and a new earth, a whole new created order. And when that happens, we will have left this age and entered into a new age, another age in cosmic history. Well, one of those ages is the final age, the last age. This is not cyclical. You know, we don't just go from this age to this age to this age and then go back to the first age and do it all over again. There's no cycle of life. There's no cycle of the gods. There's no eternal recurrence going on here. This is a straight line design that God has. We move from the beginning and we enter into the final age, which will last for all eternity. And there's progress toward that eternal age. What is that eternal age all about? That eternal age is going to be about a new physical reality and a new moral reality. Most, even more importantly than the new physical reality, this new physical reality, or the new physical reality, will be, Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians 15, so much more glorious as the flower is to the seed out of which it comes. He's talking specifically about our own bodies. I mean, take my physical body in this age as compared to the physical body that I will have in the age to come. How will I compare them? Well, this gnarly little seed that you see in front of you right now is one day going to be a beautiful something or other. Rose, you think? Really? What? Dahlia, okay. That the glory of my physical existence and my physical being then is not even worth comparing to the glory of the physical body that I have right now. Now, he speaks specifically about the physical body, but I think he would say the same thing about all of physical reality. The glory of the nature of the new earth will be as much more glorious as the seed is to the flower. And I like his imagery there, because what he's suggesting is there will both be continuity and discontinuity. It will be me, but it will be a new, infinitely more glorious me. But it will be me, just like that rose came from that seed, but you never would have been able to predict the glorious, beautiful flower that came from that seed. Likewise, we would never even be able to imagine the glorious, beautiful creature that I will be one day coming from this seed, but it will be me, because there will be continuity there. That's in another age. That's in the final age. Not only, and what about that physical world? In that physical world, it will be structured according to utterly different principles. I would have to assume that when God creates the new heaven and the new earth, all of our physics books will be totally irrelevant and obsolete. The law of entropy will not apply. The law of entropy in physics today, in thermodynamics today, suggests that the nature of physical material reality is such that it is, in a sense, if you will, winding down. It is losing steam. It is losing the ability to do work and maintain its distinctive, discrete structures and organization and so on. In other words, we are headed toward lukewarm tapioca pudding, a big pool of tapioca pudding. That's where we are aimed. And left alone, just leaving the law of physics alone, that would be our end. That would be our destiny. But that's not going to happen. It's going to go up in flames first, and after that has occurred, God will recreate a new heavens and a new earth, and those are going to be eternal. If they're going to be eternal, then they can't be a physical reality with a mechanism, a law built in that makes it finite, that makes it so that it could not endure. It will endure. It will last forever and ever and ever. That's the claim. That's the physical reality. So it is indeed everlasting life that we will have in the age to come. But even more importantly, there will be a moral transformation. So that instead of being inherently evil people, we are going to be gloriously good people, gloriously godlike in our moral purity and our moral integrity in the age to come. That's the inheritance that Paul describes, for example, in Romans 8, when he talks about you're children of God, and if children, heirs of God, and the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Well, what is that glory primarily? It's the glory of being finally conformed to the image of God himself. His holiness becomes ingrained in me as a holiness that I possess, a moral holiness. So that being a loving, merciful, gracious, compassionate, truthful, righteous person with pure integrity is as natural to me as breathing or my heart beating in that new age. It's that new glorious body in a new glorious creation where sin is not destroying my experience and robbing, sucking all the reward and fulfillment and joy out of my experience. That is what he's trying to capture by the notion of life or eternal life. You know, this existence ain't bad when you look at it in terms of all the gifts and all the joys and all the delights and all the pleasures that God has given us as gifts in this creation. It really is not half bad. The problem, of course, is my existence is so spoiled, is so marked and distorted by my own selfishness, my own greed, my own perversion, my own struggles with my own identity and the way they express themselves in my life, not to mention your greed and selfishness and lack of love and so on. And you bring us together, and we can destroy a lot of good times by our interaction with one another. So a lot of the joy that's potentially there just gets sucked right out of our existence because for no other reason than my own sin and unrighteousness. I'm just an evil, selfish person. That's going to be gone in the age to come. But what he's promising me, life without sin, without evil, without all the garbage, and without the finiteness and death that is built into physical existence, that is what I was made for. That's what you were made for if you're a human being. God's ultimate plan, his ultimate design, his ultimate rational order was to make creatures, human beings, who were destined to experience life with a capital L. And that, and nothing less than that, is the good that God intended me to attain to. anything less than that will not really satisfy what my own intuitions and my own heart knows that I want. Coming back to a couple weeks ago when Wes was taking us through Ecclesiastes, that's why in this lifetime all is futile. Futility, emptiness, emptiness, all is emptiness. This is all empty, because even if you get all the best that life has to offer in terms of its delights and pleasures and goodies and so on, even if you amass all the best, there's still a gnawing hunger in the heart that is not satisfied, because I was made for life, and what this world gives me is not life. It's only a bare shadow of the life that I was created for. So, within the scope, within this plan that was planned by the original rationality who created this world, was life, and this life was the light of men. And then here's this incredible statement. Now this light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not, my New American Standard has comprehend it, scratch that, should be extinguish it. They might even have that in the margin, do they? No, overpower. Extinguish is the best translation. In the papyri, I've run across a couple of examples, evidently it's pretty common, where it's the word that you would use when you are snuffing out a candle. And that's why I think extinguish is such, it would be a good translation. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not extinguish it. What's he saying? The good news, and that's why this is the prologue to his gospel. What is the good news? The good news is, whereas we were created for life, we live in a dark world, and the darkness of this world, and by that he means the foolishness, the deception, the evil, the perversion, the perversity of human beings in this world, all of the darkness of the human heart and mind had the potential for destroying completely any hope of us entering into and attaining the life that we were created for. Human evil could have prevented us from arriving there. The good news is, it didn't prevent it. The fact is, the light still shines in the darkness, and now I think he's slightly shifting his metaphor for light, whereas before it was just a symbol of the ultimate good for mankind. Now he's taking it into this imagery of light and darkness, and here it's, I think, a symbol of hope. That is a symbol, not just any hope, but a symbol for the hope of one day attaining my true fulfillment, attaining that for which I was created, this life. So the light shining in the darkness is just this metaphorical picture of the possibility of me actually entering into the life for which I was originally created. And that light is shining. The darkness did not extinguish it. The light still shines. So the possibility still remains for you and I to enter into that life. How does the possibility remain? John says, well, let me tell you a story. And then you have the rest of the gospel, starting in verse 6 and so on. There came a man named John that introduced us to Jesus and the whole thing. I just think it's a really, really incredibly ingenious piece of literature in terms of setting us up for the story of Jesus. Okay, now, that's, I think, what the prologue of John is saying. I won't preach on this at this point, just to save time, but the really important part of this passage, I think, is to come to terms with what verse 4 is saying. That he's defining for us the purpose of our existence. Nothing in all of existence is worth having except for being qualified for life itself. If I miss out on life, I've missed out on everything that my existence has to offer. That's what Jesus had in mind when he said, what does it profit a man if he gained the whole world and lose his soul? By losing his soul, another way he could have put it is, and lose out on life itself. Lose out on eternal life. Your and my project in this existence should be to figure out what the cosmic design is by the Logos who created it, understand that my destiny, the only meaningful destiny for me is life, and therefore the only meaningful project for my life is to make sure that I'm qualified to enter into that as an inheritance. Nothing else matters. Nothing else will fulfill my existence. Okay, now, you probably noticed that there's a lot of things I did not say about this passage that you have heard and you have assumed are true about this, and I need to address that. Why do I not say that the Logos is Jesus, or at least the pre-incarnate Jesus? Because that's typically where people go with this passage. They immediately will tell you the Logos, well, that's Jesus. Or if they're a little bit more theologically sophisticated, that's the second person of the Trinity who became incarnate in the man Jesus later in history. I can't prove that that's wrong. It's not impossible that that's the way this passage should be taken. But let me tell you why I go the direction that I do in this passage. And I think the only way for you to see this is to do this for yourself. I mean, I can tell you that I've done it, but you really need to do this for yourself. Is to sit down and take these five verses and boil them down to the statement that is being made. And then ask yourself the question, is there any sort of coherent progression here that makes any sense? If you take it to be Jesus or the pre-incarnate Jesus or the second person of the Trinity or something, you really don't need the first three verses at all. They don't add anything. They don't contribute anything to John's argument, I would argue. To say, in him was life, and the life was the light of men, it could be that you would be saying that, well, Jesus is the source of life, and Jesus is the one who came to bring light to the world. That's not the way I interpreted it, even as the Logos, but if you're going to make it Jesus, then that probably makes a lot more sense. In Jesus was life. Is that true? Of course that's true. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. He told us that he was the life. He also said that he was the light of men in another context. So if it's going to be Jesus, then it's probably going to be saying something similar to what Jesus said of himself in those contexts. In Jesus was life, and the life was the light of men. Now the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not extinguish it. Those two would probably work as a prologue to John's Gospel, but what on earth are the first three verses doing there then? Well, that's so I have something to say to Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, that's the way we treat it. We're not looking at it as a piece of literature. We're just looking at it as a kind of these random, disconnected verses that we mine for doctrinal and theological proof texts to use against whoever we need to use against them. Now, if you don't see the importance or the preferability to reading this as a coherent piece of literature. I don't mean literature. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying there. As a coherent text, as a coherent argument, as a coherent product of John's mind, then I have nothing I can say to persuade you. I'm just utterly convinced after 20 some years of studying the Bible that this was not written in a fortune cookie factory. This was written by people who are actually making arguments, making a case, trying to persuade, trying to write a piece of text that's going to convince his readers of something. And it flows, and it's coherent, and it's supposed to be read that way. It's supposed to be understood that way. What I'm arguing is that if we don't make the word, if we don't interpret it the way that I'm interpreting it, we don't really any longer have a coherent piece of text in these five verses. The prologue is completely random and scattered and fragmented, and it doesn't really fit together in any particularly coherent way. And therefore, I prefer the way that I've gone, because I think it can account for what John is doing. He's progressing. Well, the best thing to do, I think, at this point is to open it up for your questions, because I can't anticipate where you might be wondering or confused. So let me open it up for your questions. Bob?
Maybe one of the reasons that the first five verses have been taken the way they have has to do with verse 13, where John explicitly links the Logos with certainly seems like Jesus. Tell me it's not.
Verse 14?
Yeah.
Right.
So in what sense then, and does John have any of this in mind? In what sense does Jesus embody this Logos? And how does John, I mean, if John goes on to say the Logos became flesh and here's Jesus, where and when and how has he made that transition from Logos as a principle or as this concept to Logos becoming flesh?
Well, he makes that transition in verse 14. The problem is, he tells us explicitly who the Logos is in verse 1. The Logos is God. And then in 14, he says, Logos, that is to say, God, became flesh. I think verse 14 is the first time the incarnation is coming into the picture here in John. He is explicitly saying that Jesus is the incarnation of God himself, the incarnation of the Logos. But I'm not sure why we have trouble with this, but there are a lot of people who do have trouble with this. Somehow they feel like the Logos already had to be an incipient Jesus, otherwise he couldn't do this. But I mean, even our Orthodox theology tells us that Jesus is the incarnation of God. So I think we can take John at face value. The Logos is God. God became flesh. And he happened to be called Jesus of Nazareth. Am I missing part of your...
No, not at all. No, that's good. It just seems... I'm wondering... Maybe I'm even wondering why John... to equate God and Logos... I mean, when I studied math many decades ago, there was this little equivalence sign, which meant that both things on both sides of the sign were absolutely equal. And that's not the kind of equal sign, I think, that is meant here. God is much more than this principle
of reason
and rationality.
That's true.
So, is John intending to highlight just this aspect of God as being somehow embodied in Jesus when he becomes a man? And if so, what does he have in mind?
That's a good question. I don't think I haven't thought about it enough to have a good answer to that. Because, in other words, why didn't he say God became flesh rather than the Logos became flesh? Or if he found something, some other aspect of God more important, why not some other aspect of God? I'm not sure. That's a good question. The only thing that I was actually thought about that a little bit last night. The thing that does occur to me is what Jesus told us what he came for. He did not come. How's he put it? I did not come to something to be served. No, I did. I came to give my life for many. I did not come to, but to. I did not come to condemn the world, but to something and give my life a ransom for many, something like that. Yeah, that was his purpose. Well, that's in keeping with the Logos, the plan, the structure, the order, I think. And that may be what he's trying to capture here. This infinite original plan of God with in all of its rationality, in all of its design, in all of its order, in all of its structure, It came to earth to accomplish its purposes. Because Jesus' death on the cross really was a part of the original purposes in the very mind of the original designer himself. Now, I know that's not actually, even if we agree to it, many, many Christians today don't actually think in those terms. They think of Jesus as an afterthought. That here God created this world and it was going to be just fine and then we screwed it up and then he said, oh man, what am I going to do? Oh Jesus, thank God you're here. But that's not, I mean, every clue that we have in the New Testament the Lamb of God slain before the foundation of the earth. That doesn't sound like an afterthought. I mean, every clue that you have in the New Testament suggests that as part of the Logos himself, right smack dab in the middle of that, is the dying Jesus as the ransom for the sins of mankind. So that does occur to me as a possibility. Something like that is what he's trying to capture there. But I'm not really sure. It's a good question. Yeah, Chris.
Can you explain a little bit how they're not directly equivalent to the Logos and God? It made it sound like the God was more than the Logos, and what's that?
Well, simply that, and you'll have another passage where God is love, is a passage in 1 John, for example. Does Logos include that? Well, you could argue that it does, but this is certainly not emphasizing God in his attribute as love. It's rather emphasizing the attribute of his rationality and ordering and designing the architect. This is God the architect, not God the loving Father. But he's both. So in that sense, this is just trying to highlight a particular aspect of who God is. Roger?
John later says, there's a light that comes into the world that enlightens every man. Mm-hmm. Is that another twist on the word light as yeah. enlightenment? Or
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, one thing that, if you'll notice in, I think the word logos is used consistently throughout here as what I would call the original rationality which gave design and purpose to the cosmos. And I think he's using logos consistently throughout this section as that. But when it says all things came into being through it in verse 3, I'm not sure that the antecedent of that is strictly logos in the sense of it's not that all things came into being through the original rationality which gave design and purpose to the cosmos. Rather, I think there... He's talking about the plan itself rather than the planner. He's talking about the blueprint rather than the blueprint maker, whereas Logos is the blueprint maker, I think. But interestingly, he only uses a pronoun from verses 3 through 5. He doesn't use the word Logos. He just uses a pronoun. And I would take the pronoun, the actual real antecedent of the pronoun, to be the design that is implied by a designer, if you see what I'm saying. So all things came into being through it or in view of it, in view of the design that the designer made, in view of the blueprint that the blueprinter, that blueprint, who makes blueprints? Huh? You make blueprints that Roger made.
Well, the way I was trying to put that together was that the enlightenment that men get comes from their interaction with the light. In other words, when Jesus came on the scene, he forces people to look at themselves in a whole different way. So there, when he came on the scene, a certain kind of enlightenment was possible. Because for one, he became a model human being. Mm-hmm. He showed us what righteousness would look like. He gave us a taste of what it would be like in that unlike life. And then we also have to face our sinfulness because of the cross. So that's the way I was taking that verse. Am I really far off?
No, I think that's possibly right. I haven't, in my study, I haven't really gone far enough into the chapter there to have a firm conviction one way or the other about what sort of enlightenment John has in mind when the true light came into the world. But that sounds reasonable to me, and I don't think it's inconsistent. I think he would be just changing his metaphor, basically. When the light shines in the darkness and the darkness did not comprehend it, you really have him moving from 4 to 5. Light is already beginning to change from one metaphor to another. In 4, it's just a symbol of the good of man. In 5, it's actually becoming a part of a metaphor, of the metaphor of light shining on and not being put out by the darkness. I think he's connecting it to the symbol in 4, but I don't think it's just simply the same symbol all over again. And I think that metaphor then gets taken on into the rest of the chapter. The light shining in the darkness, actually, then he goes on to develop that a little bit further, well, really, what is that hope that, that keeps the possibility of life alive? Well, it's Jesus. He's the light that, and at that point, then I have a question. Does it just mean that he's the source of our hope? Could be. That could be what he means. Or does he mean that he's the one that's actually coming to reveal the plan, reveal the truth? That's another way, reason it might be Logos. Here the plan has become incarnate in terms of the plan has come to reveal itself to mankind. And I can't choose between those right now because I haven't really thought about it enough. But with enough work, I think we could figure that out. Yeah. Kevin?
Within this context, with the first verse there, where Logos is with God, mm-hmm. and Logos was God, there's a distinction being made there, but it's one of those wonderful paradoxes where there's a distinction, but it's this, it's one. And then this Logos emerges as this kind of principle or force through which all things are, all things come into being somehow. And then further down into the text, this Logos develops into the person of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to get a handle on this. Heard this referred to as Christ, the principle and the purpose. And if you...
Wait, say that again.
Christ, comma, the principle and the purpose. And if you unpack that, what was being referred to is Christ as the embodiment of this principle that was in the original purpose of God.
Okay.
Does that fit?
Yeah, I think so. That I think there's probably hundreds of different ways somebody could go with that, though, and I'd want to see the details. How do we want to spell that out? How do we want to? What principle exactly? And how is Jesus the embodiment of that? But I think if we answer those questions rightly, then I think that's probably right. And probably what he has in mind by the Logos became flesh, that there's something embodied in the purposes of God that are being somehow incarnated, fleshed out in the person of Jesus. So, in principle, I don't have any problem with that. Back to an earlier thing you said, though, I'm not convinced that he's making a distinction, though, between the Logos being with God and the Logos being God. I think that's probably more... I don't know. I think if we knew more about the culture into which he was writing, we would understand better why he puts it that way. I imagine he's writing to people who are not accustomed to thinking of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the Logos. And so I'm assuming he's trying to sneak up on them. In the beginning was the Logos. Well, yeah, sure, we can agree with that. The Logos was just as original as God himself. Okay. In fact, the Logos was God. That is, it's not... I don't see him saying something mysterious and paradoxical so much as just in the rhetoric of what he's doing. He's incrementally taking them to his ultimate claim that God, the Logos, is none other than God himself, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So I don't think it certainly could be taken the other way, but I'm not persuaded that he's trying to say two things there, but just one thing. God is the Logos.
So somehow this seems to me has to be distinct from the universal mind concept that say Christian scientists are into, which it's just It's just this far away from sort of the cosmic consciousness and the whole quantum physics theory of the no-thingness between the particles, and that's where God is. I've heard those tapes. That's what I was referring to the other night. We discussed this back in 92. And ever since then, I've been struggling with this. Maybe you could help me out a little bit here.
The Greek view of the Logos is not the whole idea of world consciousness as being, or the words world soul or something like that. Take Plotinus, for example. Plotinus very clearly had a view of a world soul. But the world soul was under the Logos for Plotinus. So he had something very similar to a more modern view of world consciousness or world soul or something like that. He did have that view, Plotinus did, but he even saw that as inferior to and subordinate from and derived from Logos. So whatever Logos is for them, it's something that transcends the created order and is the architect and author of the created order, not the soul of the created order. That's a more modern notion that they would have, you know, that's not a part of their thinking. And I don't think John could have used that quite as readily as he can their concept of Logos, because their concept of Logos is a creator kind of role. He's the rational creator of everything.
Distinct from the creation.
Yeah. And that's what he's trying to say. God is that rational creator, that architect, that designer. Does that help?
Yeah.
Gene?
Okay, if he's talking basically to Jewish-born Christians?
That's a good question. let me say yes. I'm not sure, but...
So, I'm a Jewish-born Christian. What do I think before he says this?
I think you think this. I don't think he's saying anything particularly shocking to you. Maybe you're not accustomed to identifying God by name with the Logos. Maybe that's a little bit unusual, perhaps. But I doubt it. I mean, the Jews of that time had been very Hellenized and were quite frequently casting their theology into Hellenistic categories and thought forms.
So why is he saying this, then? Just to kind of get it all organized? And if this is how they already think?
Well, let's say that I had come into this room and I was going to present the gospel to you. Let's say I was to go to the synagogue up the street and present the gospel to them. And my prologue to it was, look, we know who God is. God is the architect, designer of everything that happened here. There isn't anything that happens, so that occurs or that exists, that God has not purposed to come into existence. What did he have in mind when he created this thing? Well, he created you and I for life. And I might define life. Well, the gospel is all about how life is still a possibility for us. The evil and the corruption and the perversion of this world has not eliminated the possibility of you and I entering into life. I haven't really, up until then, I haven't told you anything that you don't already believe. But I've reminded you, here's our worldview, here's where we're coming from, here's the perspective that we have on all this. It might be new when I say life is the light of men. I mean, theologically, that's not all that shocking, but in terms of my everyday living, it's radical. It's revolutionary. So that might be a little bit new. But my basic construct of seeing God as the author and architect and designer of everything, that's not radical to a Jew. He's just setting the foundation of common ground with his readers. Tucker?
I've heard you over the years talk on this subject, not specifically just these verses, but the whole concept of life. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like that would be a really good thing to kind of unpack some more, in the sense that I'm looking for life, and I think everyone that I've met is looking for life. We want to be happy. We want to have things that are going to fulfill us. We want to have relationships that are going to be meaningful. We'd love to be able to have, say, work that's meaningful. If we're in school, it'd be great if our education was really wonderful and we didn't feel like we were just jumping through hoops. There's a lot of that that's going on. And then to the degree that... And I would say that I'm striving for that. I'm trying to do the best that I can in this world. And then to the degree that I see those things being sabotaged, I'm trying to see where the low spots are and jump over them. I'm trying to avoid the problems, the hazards. It's kind of like a little bit, life can be kind of like this crash course thing. You're kind of trying to avoid, running into the wall. And to the degree that I recognize that, I'm a sinner. I have a tendency to be hurtful and to be selfish and whatever. I'm trying to become aware of that, and trying to be aware of where and how I'm a sinner, and trying to avoid doing things that I know are wrong. And so basically I'm trying to be a good person, trying to get as much out of life as I can. I guess that the big question then is, why sometimes do I feel like, wow, this is wonderful, and it seems like maybe life is possible, this concept of life is possible in this world, and then why is it that I can't seem to keep that wow going?
It's not in it was wow, and this wow is the light of men. It's in it was life, and this life is the light of men. And I think we will probably be having wow experiences throughout all of eternity, for everlasting. But I would imagine that the wow experiences of the kingdom of God will be just as fleeting and temporary as the wow experiences of this life. They'll be 10 times more glorious, perhaps, but they will still be fleeting. They may be a tenth, at a decelerated rate, but they will nonetheless be fleeting. Why? Because the real substance of my existence is not in the wows of this life, but it's in that settled, profound joy that comes from having a sense of well-being, I think.
What's the difference between that and that moment when you are just sort of sitting back and things are kind of quiet and you just don't feel that moment, a lot of tension from pressures of the world, and for a while you kind of feel content and you say, life's really kind of good. And then an hour later or the next day, suddenly you're just going, kingdom of God, come now. and it's real easy in those situations to say, I would be just wonderful content if it just weren't for some of these other people.
Haven't you answered your own question? That the reason it doesn't last is because I go on existing, and other people go on existing, and my sin finds a way. Sin finds a way to wreck my life, wreck my peace, wreck my rest. And even the rest that I do have, even the sense of well-being that I do have in this life, is partially illusory. I can only have that sense of well-being to the extent that I selectively ignore certain aspects of what I know. Namely, I'm an unworthy sinner. I know that. I just, when I have any sort of sense of peace about my life, I don't have that in view at the moment. Because if I did have it in view at the moment, it would kind of bum me out, or potentially it could bum me out. But what about an existence where it's not even an objective reality that I'm a morally unworthy person? That's not even an objective reality. It's not that I've had to sort of selectively forget that, it just ain't true. I'm actually a morally glorious being. I mean, that's the ultimate well-being, is when I really can be satisfied with who I am, because I am truly worthy, truly glorious, to use a biblical language. That I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, my view of heaven is much like C.S. Lewis' view of a perfect world, in a sense. It may still be fraught with adventure and danger and any number of things. I mean, if this world is like that, why not all the more in the kingdom to come? There will be the ups and downs emotionally. There will be ecstasy and joy, and there will be maybe even what we call depression, God forbid, in the kingdom of heaven. But it will be all in the context of a settled wholeness and well-being. All is well with my soul because I am a good person, a person with integrity, and I am ultimately profoundly satisfied, ultimately profoundly fulfilled, and my life is one of joy, of a settled joy. But see, I mean, you use the word happy, and I know we use the word happy this way. I'm not faulting you for that, but I do think it's important that we want to be happy, yes, but we shouldn't want to be happy. That's to miss the whole point. I don't want to be happy. I want to be filled with joy, and those are different. What I want is to be fulfilled. What I want is to be whole. What I want is well-being. What I want is all to be right. And then happiness will come and go. That's okay. I mean, how do you even define happiness? Happiness is beating South Eugene. But how many of you are even going to remember that tomorrow? Smart Alec.
I don't know. I went to South.
Okay. Feel free to go. I will. I'll still answer your questions here if you have some. But.
Right. Well, this ionic life that you're talking about that we're going to be experiencing in the life to come, in the age to come. Are you saying then that ionic life, there is no way, absolutely none, possibly at all, period, that we can get even a taste or a glimpse or an idea of that here in this life? Because what it sounded like what Tucker was kind of saying is that, you know, sometimes I really get a sense or an understanding of what that ionic life is going to look like.
Oh, no, I think at the moment, it's like what Tucker described, we are getting a taste of it, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But it's not a lasting taste. I mean,
right, that's the problem. It doesn't last, and it's just not as real as what the real thing is going to be.
So you would say then that ultimately there is no ionic life to be found in this life.
Right.
But we can get, by the grace of God, we can get glimpses of it.
And you realize how radical my answer is. Because in our Christian culture, typically, we are suggesting that we can have life here and now. Now that I'm a Christian, Jesus has come and he's given me life, and I have life. The way John is using the word life, I'm quite convinced that he means that as something that is waiting for me in the age to come. It's not something that I enter into here and now. I enter into my sanctification now. And I can, in the sense of the well-being and that sense of peace, that is a foretaste, in a sense, of the ionic life that is to come, but it's not what John means by life.
Life, the big life, the life with capital L.
Right. See, our strategy in evangelism is come to Jesus and your life will be fixed. And that just ain't true. It's not what Jesus is saying. The reason we come to Jesus is so that we'll be qualified for the age, for the an inheritance in the age to come. Life right now may be downright miserable, and something that we have to persevere through. But those who persevere will get the crown of life, James says.
The Bible, in fact, kind of almost promise that if you're a believer, your life is going to be miserable.
Yeah.
There's a good evangelism poster.
Come to Jesus and your life will be miserable. I can't turn to it right away. Jesus makes a comment once. He's saying to his disciples, he says, if you give up father and mother and wife and children and riches and so on and come after me, I will give you all these things back sevenfold and much persecution. Such a deal.
What was that last part?
And much persecution.
Well, it's true we're going to have a lot of persecution and problems, but as far as the joy and so on, fit in as far as the existential part of our walk with God, and we had talked before about the existential being basically. It could relate to a personal type relationship, keeping it elevated or from being elevated or anything. But basically, the idea of learning to hunger and thirst for righteousness and learning to make choices increasingly. So, like in 2 Peter, he says that we have these different things, and if they're increasing constantly, and so on. How does that fit all into this? Because it seems to me that's where our real joy would lie, in basically in God's love and in His righteousness, and learning to function. And even though we're going to fall miserably short, we're going to have our problems in the midst of all that. It seems like that's where the life we probably really stand on.
Well, I'm not sure I'm grasping your question, but I think almost without fail, what the New Testament is saying is, where does your joy come from now? Your joy now comes from the fact that you have a hope of an inheritance in the age to come, a hope in eternal life or whatever. Our joy now comes from our hope, and the things in this life, including including tribulation, including trials, even though they are painful, even though they involve suffering and sorrow for me, nonetheless, I can experience joy in the midst of them because I realize the significance of what's going on. That trial, which is testing the authenticity of my faith and is showing my faith as authentic, is, at the same time that it's showing my faith as authentic, is showing my inheritance as real. And since I come to see my inheritance as real, I therefore that's a basis for joy, because wow, I am destined for eternal life. I am qualified for eternal life. I am one of the children of God who's going to inherit the promise.
Okay, but then with that as being the basis, is where I'm getting at. With that as being the basis of understanding that, and obviously the hope that we should have now by its faith and hope. Obviously, through trusting God, we begin to understand what hope is and joy. But then comes love, too, because the more we have the trust and the hope, the more that we are motivated, as God gives us that hunger, toward love and toward His righteousness.
What do you take love to be there?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question.
Yeah, I think that's the love of God in that context.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And it's and of course God's love toward us, but then also learning to love others in His love.
Yeah, in that particular passage though, and now abide faith, hope, and love, I think there the love that he's talking about is my love for God. What are the three things that are universally important? That I believe the gospel, that I have a hope in the promised kingdom to come, and that I love God.
Okay.
Those are the three constants in a believer's life.
Okay, and then that love, and there's other scriptures that talk about the fact that if you love God, then you're also going to love the
Spirit. Sure, right, absolutely.
So then that's going to, in other words, it starts working
right.
its way out.
Right.
And then so it seems like, I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, and I'm going to have to recheck some of the scriptures out, but it seems like the joy would be more made more complete as we learn to love our brothers and as we reach out in love. It's just a, it's kind of a, it's almost like a constant process in which we're learning to do. The dogs didn't fall for it, fall short of mm-hmm. all of us.
Well, I think there certainly is a joy. That's the trouble with all this kinds of language. When we talk about joy, I mean that there's so many different facets to that, so many different kinds of joy, so many different ways to experience joy. Is there a joy in just doing what's good and right because it's good and right? Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes
there is.
Feel it though, but.
Yeah, but ultimately we're motivated by that sense that it's a good thing to do the good thing. And part of what it means to be a child of God is that I am actually sensitive to that joy. I actually respond to that joy. I'm not dead to that joy. I am drawn by the joy of being righteous and godly and loving and good. The joy of being that kind of person is something I'm sensitive to. And I experience, and I respond to it. So, yeah, I think there is a joy that, but the New Testament doesn't really talk about that much that I'm aware of, that I can remember. But certainly my experience bears that out.
Well, you can't put a formula together here. I mean, it's obviously, and that's the typical thing that Christians and everybody want to do is put formulas together. And you can't do it, but, you know. Mm-hmm.
The title of your talk has something to do with the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't really get to the gospel, did you?
Well, yeah.
You
well,
the
no. It's the prologue to the gospel. Yeah. We do have a brief statement of the gospel here, namely, what is your existence all about? Life. Is life possible? Yeah.
So the good news is
life is still alive.
Life hasn't been snuffed out.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the good news.
Okay. Now, I have these debates with people sometimes about the order of salvation, and a lot of times they come to passage like verse 12 or 13, where they want to claim that this new birth is a reward for faith. Faith comes first, and then you get this new birth. I maintain that the faith is part of the birth, or at least the birth comes first, and the faith is kind of a characteristic of someone who has been birthed. Birth more or less, I can't find another word, but born. That's a good one.
It's too easy.
Can I anticipate your question? Okay. They're confusing the metaphor here in verse 11 and 12. They're saying, he came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. That is, they're reading that, to them he gave the right to be born again. Right? So my rebirth, my regeneration, my transformation comes if first I receive him. So I do the receiving, he does the regeneration, he does the transforming. You're saying, everything else seems to suggest that he regenerates me, that's why I receive him, right? Okay, you're right, I think. John is not contradicting you, because to become children of God is not to be reborn. That's not the metaphor that he's using here in children of God. He's using children of God here in the same way that Paul is using children of God in Romans 8, heirs. People destined to inherit the promises. So who has a right to inherit the promises? Those who have received him. Why did they receive him? He's not telling us. Not here. He does that later in the book. But right here, he's just saying there's two kinds of people. Jesus came into the midst of his own people, offering them the promised salvation that had been promised by the prophets of old. His own people did not receive him. But those few that did receive him, to them he gave the right to be heirs of the promises. And that's the way it needs to be read. And that, therefore, this passage is not even addressing the issue that's being debated one way or the other.
Well, we're not born of blood, or...
Well, yeah, that's true. In the next verse, he addresses that. Yeah.
So, okay, well, see, because by being forced to study this harder, I think there's a parallel between chapter 3 and... or at least chapter 3 puts flesh on them. Because John's coming out. Chapter 3 starts off with Nicodemus coming to Jesus and saying, you do a lot of things that really show that you must be from God. And then Jesus blurts out this non sequitur. Well, you know, those who are born of... those who are born from above, unless you're born from above, you can't see or born again, you can't see the kingdom of God. And so then, what's he saying? How is that an answer to Nicodemus' question? And I would say, it's an answer to Nicodemus' question because Nicodemus was willing to go far enough to say that Jesus was from God, but he wasn't willing to go far enough to say that Jesus was the Messiah. And Jesus is saying, well, you can't see the evidence all around you that I'm the Messiah because you haven't yet been born from above. Those who are born from above will be able to see that all the evidence points to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so then in chapter 1,
you know, Nicodemus helped bury Jesus eventually.
So, for example,
he was sometime between chapter 3 and chapter, and the end of the book, he was born again. But anyway.
No, somewhere in there, there does seem to be this parallel between chapter 1 and chapter 3. And I'm taking those who are not born of blood or the will of man
but of God.
A similar statement.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right. Yeah. The people you're debating, though, are ignoring that verse anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not looking at that verse. They're just looking at as many as received him, to them he became the right to be children of God. And I'm saying they're equating being children of God as being born again, but that's not right. It's the next verse that is being born again. Those who are born of God, in verse 13, those are the ones that are born again. The children of God are just people who have a right to the inheritance that God has promised. Well, how do you get the right to that inheritance? You receive Jesus. How do you receive Jesus? You have to be born of God to do that.
So, to get back to my original question then, that seems like to me that would be good news to a Jew.
Which?
The fact that the promised inheritance was not snuffed out.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful news.
Not snuffed out, not extinguished. That part of the thing that makes it the good news is that God's loving kindness is everlasting. In other words, He's keeping His promises, and this is precisely how He's going to do it. He's going to do it through this guy, Jesus, who became the Messiah.
Okay.
The whole story after that. But basically, they were looking forward to the promises of Abraham, and John's good news is this is how it came about.
Yeah, Tom?
Not being much of a student these days, I don't know much about this book, but you said that it was written to Jews?
Well, I don't know.
I guess what's confusing to me is I see this Greek entrance to this book, and I don't know why it's written to Jews, and I don't really have a good understanding of the background. But I'm wondering, is there any more background that would be more convincing that it's written to Jews? Because it seems to me, if it is, it may just be written in a Hellenistic setting to challenge the the other logoses of the day, or is it giving Jews ammo against, or for the other purposes that are being stated? I'm trying to understand why you have this Greek entrance if it's written to Jews.
Well,
can I throw something in there?
Sure.
Real quick?
Sure.
In that book, I even looked at, didn't he say in there that there were certain books, I'm not sure if John was one of them, that was actually originally written in Hebrew?
Yeah.
And then it was then translated into Greek later on.
Yeah. Or Aramaic, maybe, written in Aramaic and translated later. I don't know if John was one of those he suggested, but I don't think anyone knows, though, for sure. I think he's speculating there. People have speculated that Matthew, in particular, was first written in Aramaic and then translated into Greek. I don't know if anyone really knows. What I would contend, Dom, is that even if he's writing to a thoroughly, purely Jewish culture and writing this into that midst, he would still open this way. Because you have to remember that they are living in a world, the whole world has been Hellenized at this point. And the Hellenistic culture is so pervasive that any educated Jew at all is going to be familiar with certain cultural concepts that are fundamentally Hellenistic in nature. John is not a scholar, unlike Paul. Paul is quite a scholar, really. John's a fisherman. He's bourgeois, and for him to be resorting to this concept, in my mind, is proof that this is a pretty widespread concept. This is not some esoteric piece of Hellenistic literature that he read somewhere that he's showing off with. He's not that kind of
place that he's taken this approach.
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, there's probably people talking about the Logos on every corner, and they're all saying, "This is what I think. This is what I." I mean, everyone's talking about their version of what it is, because that's what Greeks were all about. Is pretty much, that was their sort of basis for education.
And that's my analogy with Mother Nature. Everybody would know what you meant by that if you said Mother Nature did this or Mother Nature did that. They know what I mean by that. The Sadducees, for example, were thoroughly Hellenized. So the whole temple establishment and the Sadducees were so Hellenized that they did not believe in immortality. They were thoroughly secularized Jews way, way, way back then. And they were the really aristocratic elite in Jerusalem. In the synagogues, they were less Hellenized in the sense that they certainly were not secularized to the degree that the Sadducees were. But there's no way that they can enter into dialogue and discussion about the things that they dialogued about and discussed without being affected by and casting their thoughts and their dialogues and their debates into Greek concepts, because it's just a part of the air they breathe now. If you take someone like Philo was a Greekophile. He completely transformed Judaism into Greek philosophy. Now he's not anyone that I would see as typical or standard, but that's how big an influence Hellenistic culture had on the Greek world of that time, is that you could have a Jew who is thoroughly Jewish who tried to do the Greeks one better on their Greek philosophy than they did. He's ready to play their game on their ground. So
you mentioned something at the beginning about how, I don't know if you said you were impressed or this was a real creative way of how he put it. And I guess if it was so common, what is it about the creativity there
it's the conciseness, it's the brevity of this thing that gets right to the heart of the matter so soon. It's sort of my answer to to Roger's question, this is the gospel. This is really all you, if you grasp this, you've got the gospel and you've got it in one sentence. Look, there's a God who designed everything. When he designed everything, he made you and me for life. We are foolish, perverse people who could have spoiled our chances at life. What's the good news? Life's still possible. Life is still possible. I didn't put it as eloquently as he did, but it's just so pithy. It just gets right to the heart of the matter. And so he launches then into the story of John the Baptist leading to Jesus and Jesus teaching and Jesus miracles and Jesus death and Jesus resurrection. And all that story is basically can be summed up by the possibility of life, eternal life, is still, the light is still shining in the darkness. The darkness did not extinguish it. Well, the story of Jesus is why the light is still shining in the darkness. I don't know. I just, you don't have to like it, but I
think it's profound. I agree with you. I just was wondering if it was so normal, you know, speech in the day, and yet it is. It's profound in very simple terms.
Yeah, where my spine starts tingling is in verses 4 and 5, not 1, 2, and 3. I mean, 1, 2, and 3 is important, but all he's doing there is setting us up for the real punchline. The light is shining in the darkness. The darkness did not extinguish it.
When you translated him, it, mm-hmm. That's just getting back to the mind, the purpose, and that he's still sticking with that. And obviously the New Testament authors have taken it to be Jesus already. Mm-hmm.
I think so, by their translation, yeah. Now,
if they could have been patient, they could have waited until verse 14.
That's what I think, yeah. And it reads much, I think it reads better that way.
Yeah. It makes more sense that way, with the language. Yeah.
Is it that pronoun, isn't it the fact that pronoun can be translated he or it?
Yeah,
It's just ambiguous.
Yeah.
It's just ambiguous.
New American Standard is.
Yeah, and the King James, I think.
It almost seems like it was written with a word processor where he had all, I mean, you know, when you're giving a speech or something, you come up with this idea and you think you're going this way, but you kind of remember this other idea that you had a year ago that really fits in and you really get excited about having it and you type it in and you think, now where do I want to put it? I think this whole part explains something, and do I want to put it here, do I want to put it there? And it kind of seems like a little bit different approaches or ideas of saying all this that is related. It almost seemed to me like those first five verses could have even been added later, like he's saying, I'm going to tell the story. And he tells the story differently than the others do because it's not exactly a, you know, it's more an idea. Mm-hmm.